Chapter 17, and with our reminder here of what's going on, David is about ready to encounter one of the biggest warriors that we know of in written history, Goliath. He's a Philistine. He's from the town of Gath, which was one of the major Philistine cities, and he's big. We've got a scale drawing of him right here. It's not completely to scale, I guess. It's, you know how artists are. You look at your own work and you say, oh, I wish I'd have done that differently. I'm sure, Dan, when you do your own woodwork, everybody else looks at it and says, that's masterfully done, and you're always, yeah, I could have done this better. Do you do that, or are you always satisfied with your work? No. Yeah. So I don't know of any artist that's satisfied with their own work. That's how you keep learning and getting better, right? Hannah is? Hannah says, yeah, I've got it. No. That's because your artwork is really good. So, anyway, this just gives us an idea of how tall and large Goliath was. He was a big man. We talked a little bit last week about how it's not crazy unusual to encounter people of this size. Even earlier this century, there was a man who was 8 foot, 11.2 inches tall. Don't forget the point two. 8 foot, 11.2 inches tall, and weighed 450 pounds. That's big. I mean, that's a tall, tall fella. So Goliath outspans that man. He was the tallest in recorded history. Too bad the Guinness Book of World Records doesn't accept biblical statement as fact, right? Because then we would have probably the tallest man, unless we go with the bed measurements of King, was it Og of Bashan? Had a bed that was 15 cubits. Long, so you've got a, no, 15 feet long. It was 9 cubits, so you've got a bed 15 feet long, so you've got a guy that's maybe 10 or 12 feet tall. That's pretty big. Going all the way back, actually, to the flood, where it mentions that there were giants on the earth in those days, men of renown. They were big, big people. We don't see that as much these days, but it does happen. And so it's not crazy, it's not out of the realm of reason to believe what the Scriptures tell us. I used to have a lot of conversations with a very skeptical man who thought Christians were just nuts to believe the things that we do about God without any sort of proof. And I would always tell him that the Christian faith is not unreasonable. It's not against reason. There's nothing in the Scripture that is contrary to human reason, and yet reason can only take you so far. There are certain things that you cannot prove. You cannot prove the existence of God, and the Bible never tries. It starts off right from the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There's no epistemological basis laid. There's no proofs given to try and reasonably prove the existence of God. He just is, and you have to accept that. Now, there are reasons that we support our faith with, yet it all comes down to the fact that I believe it, and it's true. I believe God when He speaks. So there are some things that you can show reasonable explanations for believing what God has said, and yet at the same time, reason only takes you so far. You cannot reason somebody from doubt to faith. They have to make that decision to believe it. And we run into one of those chapters this evening with Goliath. Being such a big guy, a lot of people will look at this and say that there's no way Goliath could, or this story could be true because Goliath was too big. We have never encountered somebody of that size. Well, that simply is not true. We have encountered people of this size before. So, just to locate where we are up here on the map, this is Israel. At least the southern portion of it, the Dead Sea here, the Mediterranean Sea over here on the left. 1 Samuel 17 tells us that this battle is taking place at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socah and Azekah. Socah is located right about here. Azekah is right here. And there is a valley that connects between them, and that's where we are seeing our battle happen. As I zoom in just a little bit to get us a better picture, as Zoom in. There we go. So, right here is Socah. Right up here is Azekah. Another place that's mentioned in this text is the Valley of Elah and Shearim. But also, we need to note where these towns are over here to the east or to the west, and that is Ekron and Gath. These are two of the major Philistine cities. They were two of the five major Philistine cities of the day, and they're going to come into play just a little bit later. They are just about 15 miles from where the battle is happening here at Azekah, or between Azekah and Socah. I mentioned last week that you can somewhat see on our map here that there's a valley right here. Let me see if I can move that back to center. There's a valley right here between Socah and Azekah. It has a stream running down through it. This is possibly the place that we're talking about. Now, sometimes in archaeology, you can nail down the position exactly, and sometimes you can't. In fact, if you go to Israel today, you will find two sites of the crucifixion. And I'm pretty sure Jesus wasn't crucified twice, but there are two sites. There's the traditional site, on top of which the Roman Catholic Church built a very large cathedral. But then outside of town, there is some place that's a little more popularly known as the place of the skull, or the Garden of Gethsemane. The Garden of Gethsemane sits at the base of a rock formation that looks remarkably like a skull, and on top of it is where they say Jesus was crucified. I'm not going to get into which one of those is the right one, because we just aren't sure, because some of those details are lost to history. But the important point is not where he was crucified, but that he was crucified. He died. He was buried. And the reason we don't know exactly where his tomb is to this day is because he's not in it. Everybody else we can locate when we find names on their tombs. But he isn't there. He was raised. We're going back to David, chapter 17. We covered last week the first half of the battle. David comes to the battle to bring provisions to his brothers. He sees Goliath coming out to the battle line and taunting the people of Israel because for 40 days, almost 6 weeks, Goliath has come out morning and evening and brought his challenge to the people of Israel, and nobody has accepted it. Every time, Israel has run away in fear, and this is becoming a major embarrassment to King Saul and the people of Israel that nobody is willing to face up to this enemy. Nobody's willing to say, God can take him. Doesn't matter how big we are, God could do it. Until we get to verse 38, which is where we pick up with Battle Royal Part 2. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail, and David strapped his sword over his armor. So David, going to Saul, David was talking to the men in the encampment about why nobody was answering Goliath, and that eventually got to Saul that he was doing this, so Saul summoned David to him. And when David got there, David told him, hey, God helped me, God delivered me from the bear, God delivered me from the lion, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because God's going to help me defeat him. And Saul, recognizing God's work going on in this young man, agrees to let him go, even though he's not officially of age to fight in the army. But in order to try to help protect him as much as he can, King Saul gives David his own armor and his own weapons. Because, of course, David came to the camp to bring food. He didn't bring any weapons with him except one little thing he's got, a sling. And so Saul, looking on this situation, says, that's not good enough. You need some armor. So he gives him some plate mail armor, much like what Goliath is wearing here. And he gives him a sword. But notice what David does with these things. In verse 39, he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off. Now, I want you to try and picture the look on Saul's face at this point. It might be something like, what? What do you mean you can't wear this armor? You're going to go into battle without any armor on? That's a little crazy. You're going to go into battle without a sword? David, you're going to have something to kill this guy with. Now, I want you to think, too, David is not necessarily rejecting the concept of armor because he tried it, didn't he? What's his reason for not taking it with him? I haven't tested it. Now, what does that mean? Anybody ever put on something heavy like that, equipment like that? It's not easy to move around in. David's concern is not that the armor would be bad or it would be wrong as a matter of faith to go with armor or with a sword, because we see many times in Scripture, like Jonathan, he went up fully believing that God would deliver the enemy into his hand, and who'd he take with him? A shield bearer, an armor bearer, and he had a sword in his hand. So there's nothing principally contradictory between armor and faith. Okay? Sometimes God uses that, but the issue is that God doesn't have to use it. If we really believe that God is God and that he's in absolute control of all the events of our lives and that the size of the enemy doesn't matter, that's what gives David the courage to say, I don't have to have the armor. It's not that that armor is wrong or is contrary to faith, but David says, I haven't tested them. I'm not comfortable moving around in them. This just isn't me. Ever had somebody try to turn you into someone you're not? Oftentimes in ministry, we face pressure like this because we get told, well, this guy's a really dynamic speaker, or this guy's just really good at that, or this guy's really good at that. You probably run into those things in your jobs as well, and people pressuring you to say, oh, that's really good. You should be like that. You know what? But if God didn't make you that way, don't worry about it. If God didn't make you an A-type personality, don't try to be an A-type personality. It's going to bring disaster. If you're a B-type personality or a C-type personality, be what God made you to be. Did he create you? Didn't he? Didn't he fearfully and wonderfully make you? Warts and all, God made you the way you are. Now that doesn't mean we should let every sin go, but personality is not sinful. Personality is just sometimes the way we are. Now we can use personality in sinful ways. But David's looking at the armor and he's saying, this just isn't me. When I fought the bear, I didn't have armor and God helped me. When I fought the lion, I didn't have a sword, but God helped me. And so he knows that going into battle, God doesn't need to have the armor in order to conquer the enemy. And so David says, look, this is going to hinder my movement. If I wear this stuff, I'm going to be slow, I'm going to be immobile, and that's going to be my greatest asset in this fight. Because I'm looking at this guy, and I know God can deliver him into my hand, but if I can't move around the way that I think God wants me to fight this fight, excuse me, one hit and I'm done. That's all it's going to take from this fella. So it's not that I'm going to need armor to protect me from a stroke of a sword, because if he hits me one time, I'm done. So armor or no armor doesn't make a difference. If God's going to save me, it's going to be without armor. So what a confidence, what a courageous confidence that David has in the ability of his God to say, it doesn't matter how much armor I have on. I didn't even need a sword. You're going into battle and you don't even need a sword? Isn't that crazy? Doesn't that sound just a little bit flighty? And yet we're going to see what David's going to do with that here in just a little bit, and I love it. So, David, what's he take? Verse 40. He took his staff in his hand. Now it's talking about the shepherd's crook. That thing that he would use to rescue sheep. You've all seen it in Christmas plays. Looks like a little letter S on a long pole. And they could use it to push sheep. They could use it to hook sheep and lift them up. They could use it for all kinds of things. And David was skilled in the use of a shepherd's staff. He knew how to use that thing. And so he takes a tool that he knows how to use. He also takes with him 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. David takes what he already knows how to use. See, folks, as God is going to use us, he's going to use us. And very often he uses us in the ways that we feel like we're weak or undersupplied in. So David's going to go into this battle without all of the things that are normally considered necessary for battle: armor, swords, a bunch of soldiers. But he's going to go in and he's going to recognize that God often uses what looks weak. And God uses us as we are. We don't have to become something different. Now that's what's fabulous about the church. As you look at God's picture of the body and God using the different parts of the body, he has gifted you in some way to serve in this church. And you're not going to be the same as somebody else. And you don't have to be. Because just imagine what kind of church this would be if we tried to force everybody in here to look like Pastor Brian. Oh, you'd be a good-looking group. But the gifts that he gave me are not the gifts that he gave you, and that doesn't even mean that mine are good and yours are not, and mine are better than yours. It means that those are the gifts he gave you. Use them for his glory. And that's what David's going to do here. He says, I'm not trained in the art of war, so I'm going to take my shepherd's staff. I'm going to take my sling, because that's what I know how to use, and that's what I know that God is going to give me deliverance with. Even though it looks crazy and looks like it'll never work. He says, God's not limited by our limitations, is he? Well, he goes out, says he approached the Philistine. Verse 41, and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. So here you have this guy marching toward you, and you just have to wonder how much the ground is shaking every time he steps. It's like the old Jurassic Park movies where the dinosaur is stepping and the little glass of water is going boom, boom. You see the ripples going out in it. Goliath is approaching David. Now, when Goliath gets close enough, verse 42, when the Philistine looked and saw David, what's his response? He disdained him. Yeah, not even laughter like that's funny. It angers him. Now, why do you suppose it angered Goliath? I'm asking you this question. Give me a chance to get a drink. It was an insult. It really was an insult. Here Goliath for 6 weeks has been coming out making a challenge morning and evening to Israel. Send somebody out to fight me. And then he looks and who are they sending out? Yeah, basically a child, an 18-year-old. Maybe 17, maybe 16. Somewhere right in there, mid to late teens. So Goliath looks at him and says, you guys aren't even taking me seriously now. Here all this time I thought you were afraid, and now he's assuming you are messing with me. You're toying with me. Israel's not even taking my challenge seriously. So he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy, and handsome in appearance. David must look like me. He's a good-looking guy, right? No. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. This is basically the biblical version of bleeping out swear words, okay? This is the part in the interview where they're interviewing, what is that guy? It was always on radio. Howard Stern. And you're trying to listen to Howard. I don't listen to Howard Stern, by the way, but if you're trying to, it's just beep, one long string of profanities. So this basically is God's bleeping out what Goliath is saying here. He cursed David by his gods. This is a hurling of insults and expletives upon David because David to Goliath looks like a little pretty boy. So what are you sending this little boy out here to do? What do you think he's going to do to me with a stick? Am I a dog? And so he curses David. But look at David's response here as we're considering these introductions and insults that are being exchanged here. David, I mean, how many of you were bullied in school? Anybody ever get, I guess you don't have to admit that if you don't want to. I was not afraid to raise my hand, got spit on and kicked around a little bit, and I was kind of that boy in school that got picked on a lot. And when you would see the big kids coming up to you, it inspired a great deal of terror because you just wonder, what are they going to do? And when they start hurling those insults at you, you just kind of stand there in fear because you can't run or they'll catch you. So you just really have to stand there and take their insults. And so you see this guy coming up to you, and he's probably got a deep, booming voice. What am I, a dog, that you come against me with sticks? And David just stands there and listens, but he's not afraid. Because look at his response, that he's not afraid to give back to this. Now, how many of us would have the courage to even say anything? Or would we be there going, yes, sir, I am a dog. I'm sorry, sir, I didn't mean it. You know, I mean, but David doesn't shy back in terror at all. Sorry, I'm skipping a few verses here. He cursed David by his gods. Verse 44, then the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. So not only does he start, he's hurling all these expletives and insults upon him, cursing David by his gods, but then he says, come here, I'm just going to kill you. I'm going to leave your dead carcass out here in the middle of the valley so the birds can eat you up and the coyotes can munch on you at night. Now, we've been taught to respect our elders, right? How many of you would obey this command? Come here. I always crack up in the movies when the police are chasing a bad guy and they say, stop, in the name of the law. So they're bad guys. They're not going to stop. They're not going to say, you almost got me. Cracks me up as well when you're filling out paperwork to purchase a firearm and one of the first questions is, are you a criminal? So if I was, I wouldn't tell you. That's what makes a criminal a criminal. They lie about things. But obviously, Goliath doesn't expect David to listen to this command and just come marching up. Yes, sir. Okay, go ahead. He's insulting him. He's telling David, all you have to do is approach me and I'm going to slaughter you. This isn't even going to be a fight. He's telling David, you have no chance of winning this. So if you come any closer, you're dead. And again, David doesn't stand there quivering in his boots like I would probably do. Look at his response to this. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. And at this point, Goliath's saying, yeah, that's why I'm going to win. I've got the sword. I've got the spear. I've got the javelin. You've got a stick. One little slice of my spear, and I can break that stick into pieces. And I can skewer you like a shish kebab, roast you over the fire and have dinner. This isn't even going to be hard. But David doesn't stop there. He says, you come to me with the normal weapons of war. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Here's where David really sets the crux of the matter. He says the real issue here is not just that you're a Philistine and you're our enemy. The real issue here is you have insulted God. Not just his people. You've insulted God, and he doesn't look kindly on that. And so God is going to use me today to answer you, because God uses people to accomplish his purposes and plans in the world. Sometimes God steps in miraculous ways. Sometimes he uses ordinary means. Understand that what's going to happen here is not technically a miracle, although we would kind of call it one. Miracles are in some way when God supernaturally overrides the normal operation of the world. So when he parts the Red Sea, that doesn't normally happen. That takes something extraordinary. Because the forces of nature keep water down. Gravity keeps the water at a pretty level state. God has to intervene in a miraculous way to part the waters. God's going to guide this stone. God's going to win the victory. But he's using normal means. He's using a sling. He's using a stone. He's using trajectories, and maybe Gary, with all his engineering training, could calculate for us the forces necessary. You have to do that stuff in your drafting, right? Yeah. So if a stone comes out of my mower, how fast will it be traveling? And what's the effective range? And could I aim it to hit a 9-foot-tall Philistine? I don't know. You come to me with a sword and spear, so you've got what looks to be the strength. But I have what's really strong. I have God. I have Jehovah on my side. So, his response is this. You have defied the armies of Israel. This day, verse 46, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give your flesh. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. This is a full statement that David's making here, because there are a lot of implications. David walks up to Goliath carrying what? A stick and a sling. What's Goliath got? Sword, spear, javelin, shield, armor, helmet, all of that stuff. He's fully armored. So Goliath says, come here, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to give your flesh to the birds of the air, the beasts of the field. And Goliath says, David's response is, yeah, not only are you not going to kill me, but I'm going to kill you. And at which Goliath might laugh. Okay, try to turn the tables, that sounds funny. But David continues and says, not only am I going to kill you, I'm going to cut off your head. Well, tell me how David's going to do that without a sword in his hand. So basically, David is telling Goliath, all right, you're threatening to kill me, but we're going to come to this battle, and I'm going to tell you what's going to happen, Goliath. I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to use your sword to cut off your own head. Before it even happens, David is giving this, it's not really prophetic, but it is. So you're threatening to kill me, but I'm going to tell you, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to cut off your head with your own sword. You said you're going to kill me, but I'm going to kill you. And you said you're going to give my body to the birds of the air, but I'm going to give not only your body, but I'm going to give the bodies of all of your army to the birds of the air. Talk about one-upmanship. Talk about trying to outdo somebody. Oh, yeah? Well, I can do better than that. Goliath, I could kill you in Israel. Well, he's going to. They're already there. But here's what David is doing here. He said, yeah, you're not going to kill me. I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to use your weapons to do it. And then when you're dead, we're going to kill all the rest of this army. And we're just going to leave you laying out here. And here's the reason I want this to happen, David continues, because he's not going to let this go by and think that this is about him, think this is about him trying to prove himself to his brother. Remember Eliab, who had some nasty things to say to him? But his reasoning for wanting this battle to end that way, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. So David says, I want this to happen, first of all, so that the entire world will know that God is God. The God of Israel, Yahweh, Jehovah, he is God. He's the true one. You've cursed me by your gods. I'm not going to bother cursing you, but I'm going to tell you who's going to win this battle. It's going to be God. And there's going to be no doubt about it, because I'm coming at you with nothing. And so if I win this fight, there's only going to be one way that it could have been won, and that's because God did it. I want the whole world to know that God is at work in Israel. Secondly, verse 47, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear. Which assembly is he talking to? His own. You can imagine David saying that all this assembly might know. Why do you think he's pointing back at them? Because they're all standing there in fear. They wouldn't respond to Goliath because all they could see was the armor and the muscles and the sword and the javelin and the spear. That's all they could see. And they couldn't see the power of God to defeat him. And so for 6 weeks, they all ran and hid from Goliath. And so David approaches and he says, I'm going to stand here, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to cut off your head, I'm going to defeat your entire army so that the whole earth will know that God is working through me, and so that these people back here will know they should have trusted God to take care of this. But none of them did. This is a stinging rebuke to his own people. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. Into whose hand? So who does he know is going to join the fight as soon as Goliath's dead? All right, the assembly, yeah, he knows what's going to happen here. He's going to kill Goliath, and he knows it's going to inspire all of Israel to join in this fight. But he's very clear on this point. This has got nothing to do with David. This isn't David trying to gain prestige. This isn't some young man trying to prove himself. This isn't David trying to gain the respect of his brothers who think he's not much. This is David upset that God has been insulted and nobody's answered. And so he's going to answer. Well, let's see what happens. Then the Philistine arose. Verse 48. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to David, David ran quickly. Which way? Toward the battle. Okay, show of hands. Be honest here. How many of you would run toward that? All you've got in your hand is a stick. And you run toward it. You see, time and time again here, the courageous faith of David that he's willing to say, he's so confident that God's going to win this battle that he's willing to run towards the danger. I mean, he's not even going to stand here and posture himself and look for a weakness. He's running right towards him. Now, I think he has a reason for this. He's not just being foolishly courageous, but why would you run towards a guy like this? Think about the weapon he's got in his hand. You get better aim. Okay, what's vulnerable on Goliath? Okay, well, I didn't draw completely the armor on his arms, but it says he had bronze plating on his arms. This guy's fully covered. He's like a walking tank. So what's vulnerable? Right there. That's it. That little section that the helmet doesn't cover. Okay. David's got a very narrow target. Jerry and I went to the driving range here, not last week, week before, because I needed the help of a master. And he's a good golfer. And it's because every time I hit a golf ball, it no consistency whatsoever. I said, I need some help straightening out this swing. And he watched me for a few minutes, and he said, well, try this and try this. And over about, where were we there, half an hour? Was it about an hour? See, time flies when you're having fun. I didn't think it was that long. He helped me do a couple of things, and by the time we were leaving, I was hitting them somewhat straight. So, hey, it's amazing. If I aim that direction, my ball goes that direction. Do you know how much that's going to help my golf game? Okay. When you're bow shooting, I do this, I like to shoot bow, so you have to work a lot to make sure that arrow hits the same spot. Because you don't measure your arrow shooting by one good shot. Occasionally, I can hit dead in the middle of the bullseye. But I can't do it every time. So what you do is you take a grouping. So if I shoot 10 arrows and they're all within a circle this big, you're doing pretty good. If they're all within a circle this big, not as great. But the closer I get to that target, the better I can do. When I'm shooting at 20 yards, I do a lot better than when I'm shooting at 40 yards. Because it's just a lot harder to hit something that's far away. Used to get a kick when I'd go to the shooting range with Kim's brother, shoot some pistols. And we would, at the end, we would try shooting at the full extent of the range, which was about 35 yards. So that's a pretty long shot for a handgun. And half the time, I couldn't even tell that I was hitting the target because I would take aim, kapow, kapow, kapow. It's like, I'm not sure to adjust which direction because the bullets aren't even hitting the target now. McDavid is moving in closer to get a better shot because he's got a small target to aim at. So he runs into battle line to meet the Philistine, and David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, and slung it. This is almost anticlimactic. Because here's the point in the movie where the music starts playing and you see slow motion, the guys are running toward the battle line, and then all of a sudden, it's over. David gets out the sling, starts swinging it around in circles, and you can hear the whishing of it. And he lets go, and smack, that stone lands exactly where it was supposed to land. It struck the Philistine on his forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead. Ew, that's gross. And he fell on his face to the ground. So within minutes, this battle is over. All the taunting that Goliath did for 6 weeks is over because David slung one stone. How many did he take with him? Just five, just in case. So again, we see David's not being crazy here with his faith. He's not jumping off a cliff and asking God to save him. He even takes five stones just in case the first one misses. But he runs forward to get a good shot. He slings that first stone, and God does it. and the first stone lands right where it needed to land, smacks Goliath right in the middle of the forehead, sinks in. I don't want to think about that picture. But Goliath's eyes roll back in his head. He falls forward flat on his face. And the whole earth goes kaboom when he hits the ground. I added that part, by the way. It doesn't say that. So David doesn't waste any time. Verse 50 summarizes a little bit with us. David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. That's a summary statement of what happened. Because Goliath's, well, we're not sure if he's dead yet or not. It doesn't matter much. He's going to die anyway, real soon. There was no sword in the hand of David. This detail we knew, but he's drawing your attention back to it because of what's going to happen next. David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. So here again we see David could not have been this 12-year-old boy that we sometimes see in the Precious Moments Bible, because he's strong enough to lift a sword of that size. Now Goliath, being the size he was, would not have had a small sword. He would have had a sword to fit him. He could wear Saul's armor. It's not that it didn't fit him. It's that he wasn't used to wearing it. So he's not a young boy. He's a full-grown young man. But he runs up to Goliath. And I can only assume that Goliath's shield-bearer is either stunned in shock or has run away screaming, because the shield-bearer doesn't do anything to stop David. So David runs up, pulls out Goliath's sword, and cuts off his head. And just like that, the battle with Goliath is over within minutes, within moments. And when, here's the response of the Philistine army, when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. I mean, can you imagine looking down into that valley and all the Philistines just standing there with their mouths gaping open? That fast? That's almost anticlimactic. We expected at least a good battle out of this. We expected to have some entertainment with Goliath toying with his prey, like a cat toys with a mouse. And in just a few minutes, it's over, and Goliath's dead. His head's been removed from his body, and David's standing there looking up at the armies of the Philistines, and they all start turning tail and running away. Because which of the Philistines would want to face that guy now? He just defeated our best man. Does any of us want to go up against him? Not a chance. And because of what David said, if his God can do that, we don't stand a chance. Our only hope is to make it home before they catch us. And so they're not going to waste any time. They all turn around and start running away. David was not wrong about the response of his countrymen. Because in verse 52, the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout. They've got to be excited at this point. Pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. I believe the King James there says the valley, because it's talking about, on our map here, the area of Azekah is right about on the edge of Israelite territory. And right here, the mountain ranges end. And we start descending into the coastal plain. The Philistines dwelt in the coastal plain region over there on the Mediterranean, as we've said. It's very flat land. As you get here to Azekah, up to Beth Shemesh, the mountain ranges begin, and you start getting into very hilly regions. So the first time there it says that they fled to as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. The literal word there is as far as a valley and the gates of Ekron. So they do go back to Gath. It's going to mention that later. But the word here is actually the valley. So they're descending the mountains into the valley. And where are they going? They're heading back home because they want to make it safely back to Gath. Now again, this is about a 14, 15-mile run that they're going to make here. And the whole time, Israel is pursuing them. So that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shearim. I got it right that time. Shearim, as far as Gath and Ekron. So the Philistines begin running from here, and Israel joins them, and they're cutting the Philistine people down all the way back so that there's dead Philistines and wounded Philistines scattered amongst the fields all the way back. And it says they pursued them up to the gates of Ekron. So Israel doesn't even stop when they hit the city limit of Ekron. They chase them all the way to the walls. And it's only when the gates come down and the doors shut that Israel stops, turns around, and goes home. This is how complete the victory is over the Philistines at this point. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. This was what you call the spoils of war. If you defeated your enemy, you had the right to all the stuff that was left behind. So you would strip the dead bodies of anything valuable. You'd go back to the camp and see if they left anything. Because these guys were so terrified of what Israel was going to do, they left their camp. Now remember, they'd been 6 weeks at that camp. How many of you pile up a few things in 6 weeks to make your life a little more comfortable? So you're in a tent. You know, if you're in a tent for a couple of days, you just take the bare necessities. You're going to be there for 6 weeks. You start piling things up. So Israel goes back to the camp, and they plunder it, and they take everything. And so the amount of wealth that the Philistines lose here would have been extreme. David has a few trophies of his own, verse 54. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. This was a trophy of war for him. Yeah, ugh. Okay. Not too many of us want to, we don't mount these kind of things on the wall, but we do similarly when we go out and kill a big deer, right? You have it stuffed, you put it on your wall, that's a trophy. Well, David's going to do the same thing with Goliath's head. He takes it to Jerusalem because Jerusalem would have been on the road back to Bethlehem for him. And he leaves it there as a testimony to all the Israelites that God is able to save by small means. God, just like Jonathan showed a few years earlier, it's a shame that nobody else in Israel could remember that lesson. That Jonathan went up, defeated the Philistine garrison, just him and his armor bearer. But then when Goliath comes, Israel's forgotten already, and they don't want to step out in faith and do what God told them they should do. So David leaves the head of Goliath in Jerusalem. Now a little bit later, we're going to read that David conquers the Jebusites and takes Jerusalem. Israel dwelt in Jerusalem, but there was a section up on the hill, Mount Zion, where there was a fortress. And it was that fortress that the Jebusites managed to keep out of Israelite hands for a long time. David will eventually take it, and that's where the temple will be built. But at this point, Israel's just dwelling in the village around that fortress. So he takes the head of Goliath there. He takes the armor and puts it in his own tent, and presumably the sword as well, which will come into play later. But as we get into verses 55 through the end of the chapter, we see the rewards that Saul is going to give to David. And the first reward is what we've already read. Israel gets to plunder the camp of the Philistines. So there's some of the reward of battle. The second reward, David gets the sword, the armor, and the head of Goliath as trophies. And then the third reward belongs to David's family. In verse 55, as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." Now, this has caused some scholars some great concern as well, because David has already knows Saul. Remember, he's been traveling back and forth between his father's sheep in Bethlehem and playing music for Saul. And so people have said, well, see, the Bible contradicts itself. First Saul knows David, then Saul doesn't know David. But the issue here is not who is David. He knows who David is. But remember the promise that Saul made to whoever killed Goliath. What was that guy going to get? A daughter in marriage. Family will be free from taxes in Israel. And great wealth. So David's going to get the great wealth. Why would Saul inquire as to David's father? Because that man's going to be free from taxes in Israel. So Saul is inquiring to David's family to be able to register it that Jesse no longer has to pay taxes. I'm still hoping one of my sons will go out and defeat a giant so that I can be free from taxes. Okay. Doesn't look like it's going to happen, though. They'll probably tax them for killing the giant. Any armor you collect from a victory like this is going to be taxable income, I think. Right? So, verse 56, the king said, "Inquire whose boy this is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of Jesse, your servant, the Bethlehemite." So there David lays it all out before him. Now Jesse's going to be free from taxes. David is going to be promised the daughter of Saul. And David's rise to fame and power is beginning. because God has a purpose through this young man. God's going to make him the king of Israel. And not only is he going to be king of Israel, he's going to be the type of the greatest king of Israel, the Lord Jesus. David's kingdom is going to be a shadow of what the Lord Jesus' kingdom will be in its fullness. And it'll be that in a way that Saul's kingdom couldn't be. Because Saul showed himself to be a man who wouldn't trust God and obey him in everything. And David is proving to be exactly the opposite. A man that'll risk his life to trust God. A man that'll put everything on the line to show that God is supreme. So the kingly lesson for us is, first of all, there's not a problem you have that God can't solve. Well, this proves it. He's dead. That giant is dead. God killed him. And so any problem that you're facing isn't that big. Doesn't have that much hair on it, and it isn't that ugly. God can take care of it. So our answer is, will we be like David, who ran to meet the problem because he knew God could solve it, or will we be like the Israelites who hang back in fear? And hopefully the kingly lesson is, just trust God and run towards the problem and see what God does to take care of it.